My guest is Mohammed El Arian. He is a Bloomberg View columnist and chief economic advisor at Allianz. He's also the chairman of President Obama's Global Development Council. You know, in previous interviews, we've discussed his latest book, The Only Game in Town, Central Banks, Instability, and Avoiding the Next Collapse. And he's helped us understand and get some needed perspective on the implications of the Brexit referendum. That was a big issue a few months ago. To hear these interviews again, simply go to our website, which is stevepomeranz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com, and search for Mohammed, and you will find all of our interviews with Mohammed. But now for the subject today. You know, I've recently begun a series called The Great Investors, What's in Their Wallet, which can also be found on the homepage of stevepomeranz.com. And I've asked Mohammed to join me as I consider him one of the world's greatest investors. Mohammed, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
So I've been reading about what you've been doing with your money and investors' money, and I was very kind of shocked to see that you have a lot of cash in your portfolio. Explain why you have so much cash, how much, and so on.
It's not because I'm getting paid a lot to earn to hold cash. In fact, I'm being paid nothing at all.
That's why it's so surprising,
cash.
Right?
And inflation eats away
at
the real purchasing power of your cash.
Right.
So this is not a positive decision. This is because of what else is out there. And my concern, Steve, is that we have been living through a very unusual period in which financial assets have been decoupled from fundamentals. And for good reason, central banks have tried to use the financial markets as a way of promoting growth. In other words, push up artificially asset prices, make people feel richer, trigger the wealth effect, so they go out and spend more.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it hasn't worked. So my concern as an investor is the extent to which this decoupling has taken place. Now, it doesn't mean it can't go a little bit further. It can. But I worry that we're coming to a point where central banks are becoming less effective. So the investment response to that is build in resilience and build in agility. Resilience to make sure that if prices do go down, you can still take the offensive and you're not stuck just in defense. And agility to take advantage of what are likely to be overshoots. So I have reduced my holding of public equities and public bonds. I have moved that mostly into cash, but in order to have some expected return, I've also been more active in the illiquid space, particularly in venture.
All right, well, we're going to get to that in a minute. You know, when I was researching for my interview with you, I took a look at what the PE multiple of the stock market is today. And I was surprised. The Dow is at 20 times earnings, and the S&P, according to the source I used, was at 24 times earnings. And this wasn't the Case-Shiller S&P. This was based on trailing 12 months earnings for the S&P. Now, these PE numbers bounce around a lot, so I'm never sure, you know, which one to believe. But let's just use those two as an example. And I think it does reinforce what you're saying. So when the S&P is selling at 20 times earnings, if you flip that around and you say, well, you know, I'm getting a dollar's worth of earnings and I'm paying $20 for that, what is $1 as a percentage of $20? Well, it's 5%. So you can say that my earnings yield is 5%. And then you say, well, if my earnings yield is 5%, how does that compare to other, let's say, risk-free investments? The 10-year bond is trading at about 1.8%. So I'm still getting more than that. But then you have to kind of factor in, well, how much risk am I taking to get this spread between the risk-free investment and the risk investment? If I use the S&P 500's price-to-earnings ratio of 24, then my earnings yield is only 4.2, and that seems to be very expensive, very rich. So am I saying, in effect, giving some credence or some facts to your thesis?
You are, and you've done it in a good way. I would also caution against using relative measures. So the argument, which I completely agree with, is that look around, where can you get any returns? And the only place you can get any returns or expect to get any returns is the equity market. So yes, the PEs may be high, and they are high, as you just noted, but it sure is a lot better than anywhere else. And that argument is also applied to high-yield bonds and other risky investments. The right. problem with that argument is that you are comparing it to artificially low interest rates. So while the relative case for owning risky assets may be there, the absolute case, as you just mentioned, is a lot weaker.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and it's ultimately the absolute case that matters. Investors have to remember that you are being paid to take risk. And it's an absolute concept. It's not a relative concept. You know, I used a silly example, if I may, Steve, of coming to you and saying, look, there's a cat that you can buy at $30,000, but there's a dog that you can buy at $10,000. Which would you rather do? And you would say, I would say, I'd rather buy a dog in $10,000. But that doesn't make it a good thing to do.
Right.
It may be cheaper in relative terms, but in absolute terms, it's expensive.
It's so
and that's
expensive.
My concern.
Okay. Well, I kind of understand that. So where should interest rates be? I mean, we have inflation, which is just really barely, you know, above 1%, maybe in 1.5%, 2%. Interest rates should be based on that. It should be based on the possibility of higher inflation, of economic activity. It doesn't seem like interest rates are so incredibly overpriced or under-yielding because of Fed action. Where should they be?
Let me put it a different way. We have a GDP that in real terms is growing 1.5% to 2%. We have an inflation rate that's in the 1.5% to 2%. Historically, if you were to apply this in an equation and say historically, what would have been my 10-year interest rates? It would be about 3% to 4.5%, not the 1.8, 1.9 where we are today.
Okay.
And similarly, we would not have a European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan having negative interest rates. Think about that. Negative, meaning that if you lend you money, you pay for the privilege of lending you money. And we know that that's counterintuitive.
Yeah, it's insane. It's in a bizarre world that, you know, I can't even imagine. Though I have noticed that the yield on German bonds have risen above negative. So there is some positive change there. But that's really beside the point. Your thesis is that you're keeping 30% in cash because you think markets are overpriced due to so much Fed intervention to keep the economies going and strong in their attempt to get this economy moving again. And you think that, you know, there will be a regression to the mean at some point. Prices will go down and you want to have the cash in order to buy at more attractive prices. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And I encourage a second type of thinking that complements this. Well, it's something that people don't like to do, which ask, if I end up making a mistake, which mistake can I recover from?
Yeah.
And here, there's two mistakes for investors. One is to stay out of the market and see it go even higher,
mm-hmm.
right? The other mistake is to wake up, and this happened in January and February of this year, so it's not as if it hasn't happened, wake up to a 9% loss that happens very quickly.
Yes.
And when I look both at the positive argument that you cited, and when I also look at what mistake can you recover from, I think at these valuations, Steve, it's better to recover from a mistake where you've left some money on the table than one in which you've lost quite a bit of money quite fast.
Yeah, but you have to be able to withstand some pain here, because if you're 30% in cash this year, unless your venture capital investments are just, you know, doing unbelievably well, you're trailing the market pretty considerably because the stock market's done fairly well this year.
I mean, first, the venture side has helped a lot, okay? And second, you know, when we buy insurance for our car, we don't buy insurance because we think we're going to crash the car, but we recognize that we're willing to give up some cash in order to buy significant downside protection. And that's the mindset right now, is recognize that markets are artificial, recognize not by choice, but by necessity, because other policymakers have been paralyzed by Congress. By necessity, central banks have had to do more and more experimental stuff. We are seeing lots of unthinkables and improbables becoming reality.
Yeah.
Though that's not noise, that's a signal. And my own reaction is when you see a world like that, that's hard to explain, that's hard to sustain, then taking some money off the table is a prudent thing to do.
Better safe than sorry, I suppose, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So now let's talk, we only have a little time left. Let's talk about your venture capital. So these are illiquid investments of businesses that you're getting an equity stake in with the hope that this business will grow and give you a future excellent rate of return. Can you give us a little bit more detail about the way that works?
Sure. I mean, they are focused in areas that I think are subject to disruptions by this incredible revolution that's happening in technology, artificial intelligence, big data, and mobility. It's enabling individuals to do things that they've never been able to do before, and it can change complete industries. We've seen this, of course, with Uber in the urban transportation. We're seeing it with Airbnb, and it's happening in lots of different sectors. So the idea is to try and identify these areas. Now, why are they attractive to me? Because central banks cannot reach them. So it's much harder to distort the valuations in that space than it is to distort the valuations in public markets, which is what has occurred.
But you talk about overvaluation. A lot of these disruptors, you mentioned Uber and others, they're already, I don't know if you'd say they're overvalued, but they're extremely high priced relative to what they're currently doing, and even based on future expectations of earnings. How do you deal with that fact that, you know, it's already built into the price?
So this is not buying Uber once it has matured, right, and gone through multiple rounds of financing and even IPO'd. This is trying to get them at an earlier stage. But I should caution, you know, this is a true portfolio approach. I don't know of anybody who has a batting average that's over 500 in this area.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Because by its very nature. So the payoff is very different from public markets. The payoff is if 1, 2, or 3 out of 10 turn out to be winners, you can more than afford the losses on the others.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the element. The other thing I would say to investors is don't hesitate to be more tactical. We will see the markets become a lot more volatile as these fundamentals start to assert themselves on artificial valuations. So we are likely to go through a roller coaster. And we are likely to have a situation where tactical investing, as opposed to long-term strategic investment, belongs also in your portfolio. And that's, again, against conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom says, buy it and hold it. But
yes.
Ironically, had you done that for the last 2 and a bit years, you would have earned nothing at all.
That's right.
And you would have gone through
Markets are flat, right.
A roller coaster.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's easy to say to be tactical, but to actually accomplish that in a successful way, I think is really pretty difficult. And really for the average person to try to be tactical is probably more dangerous or has more chance of a poor outcome than a positive outcome. How would you advise the average investor to be more tactical?
So first, I would say you're right, and that's a really important cautionary note. So don't be tactical on the way up. Don't get sucked in when everything else is going up, because that's the most frequent mistake people make.
Mm-hmm.
And then they compound that by selling when the markets have gone down a lot. So don't be tactical in an emotional sense is the first thing I tell you. And the second thing is have a handful of high conviction names that you really believe in. Because what tends to happen when markets trade down is what the professionals call contagion. Because of some very genuine and legitimate technical effects, the good gets thrown out with the bad for a while.
Right.
And have a few names that where these are your high conviction investment.
Mm-hmm.
You understand them. Preferably, you are exposed to them in terms of the companies, what they do and how they do it. And have them on your list. And when things look pretty awful, go back and ask your question, why did I like them to begin with? Because there's a high chance that they may have been technically contaminated as opposed to fundamentally contaminated.
Yeah, don't believe that the price movement is actually a representation of what's going on necessarily with the business. It might be, but keep your eye on the business and the balance sheet of the business. Make sure you know what you own. And then once you do that and you see the price going down with everything else, that could really represent an opportunity for, you know, a purchase. My guest, Mohammed El Arian, Bloomberg View columnist, chief economic advisor at Allianz, and also the author of The Only Game in Town, Central Bank's Instability, Avoiding the Next Collapse. And this has been one of our series of The Great Investors. What's in their wallet? And I think we really found out what is in Mohammed's wallet. So to join the conversation, to hear this again, to read the transcript, or see the summary of this, don't forget to go to stevepomerantz.com. That's P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, stevepomerantz.com. Mohammed El Arian, thank you so much for joining us today.
My great pleasure. Thank you so much, Steve.